Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the bookshop. In the spring of 2007, my husband and I and our two sons went to Washington, D.C. with my in-laws. We visited memorial sites, art museums, the Smithsonian, the Library of Congress, Mount Vernon, and the White House. We ate great food, met interesting people, lapped up the history of the United States, and snapped numerous photos of trees full of blossoms. The trip was emotional as it would be my father-in-law's final visit to one of his favorite cities, one he'd visited many times in his long-spanning career in politics. We watched as his wife comforted him when he broke down in tears at the National World War II Memorial and later at the Arlington National Cemetery. We listened to his stories while riding the United States Capitol subway system beneath Capitol Hill and dining at his favorite hangouts. Washington, D.C. is a beautiful city, a museum-goer's delight, a park-lover's haven. Today, I'm back in Washington, speaking virtually with two residents. And because my guest author celebrated the birth of his latest book last week, I'm switching things around and starting the episode with his interview, followed by the bookshop owner interview. David Ebenbach is a writer of fiction and poetry, a teacher, and an editor. He is the author of 8 books and is the recipient of the Drew Hines Literature Prize, the Juniper Prize, and the Patricia Bibby Award, to name a few. David's first science fiction novel, How to Mars, was released last week with Tachyon Books. Hi, David, and welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
I am too. It's great to meet you. First of all, congratulations on the release of your new book, How to Mars. Can you give us a short synopsis of the story, please?
Absolutely. So on a certain level, it's about a pretty dubious mission to Mars, where six people are sent on a one-way trip by an organization that's pretty peculiar and is funding the whole trip with a reality TV show. And they have just one rule for the Marsonauts, which is no sex on Mars. But as it happens, the book begins, this is how I find out Jenny is pregnant on Mars. So you can see how that worked out. On another level, I think it's really about how we live on any planet. You know, we're thrown into this universe without a lot of guidance, or the guidance is inconsistent and strange, and yet we have to move forward. And these folks are trying to do that themselves.
Just getting back to that first line, this is how I find out Jenny is pregnant on Mars. I'd like to talk about what makes a grand opening sentence, the whys and the hows, because that line had me hooked immediately.
I think there's two ways that an opening sentence can be a hook. And the one we think about a lot is that it hooks the reader and makes them want to read. But the other way is that it hooks the writer and makes them want to write. And that's what happened to me. These were the first words that came to me in the whole book. And I thought, well, I'd like to find out what I mean by that. And so it was pretty easy to spin outward from there. I just put a couple of people in spacesuits and had them bounce across the landscape. And all sorts of possibilities suggested themselves immediately.
Your thought on not only hooking the reader, but the writer is interesting and true. I like that idea a lot. Thank you. Let's go back to the first book you ever had published. Can you share with us your path from first finished manuscript to publication?
It was short stories. Although I probably should admit the dark secret that I have 7 unpublished novels in my closet, and they're going to stay there, which is lucky for everybody. But, you know, I've been trying to do this for a long time. Apparently, it takes a lot of practice. And I was very fixated, to be honest with you, on the novel as the only thing that a person should write. And so when I was taking courses in creative writing as a graduate student, I was actually supposed to be studying psychology, and I was off sneaking off taking creative writing classes behind psychology's back. And I had a wonderful teacher named Jessie Lee Kercheval, who really encouraged me. And I just started producing all these short stories, and I sent them out to get published individually and had some nice luck there. And eventually she said to me, "Don't you have enough that maybe you have a book?" Which is a thing that had never occurred to me. And it's not like I had never read a collection of short stories before. I had read lots of collections of short stories, but for some reason, I was absolutely obsessed with the novel idea. So I didn't see that. But I did pull those stories together and send those out. And I sent them to a number of contests, including the Drew Hines Literature Prize contest. And that's the one that happened. And it was a really wonderful experience. A writer that I admire a lot, Stuart Onan, picked the manuscript from others. And there was a nice ceremony in Pittsburgh, which is a town I love. And it was a lovely first experience working with the University of Pittsburgh Press, who was really attentive and energetic, a lot of fun, lots of great ideas, lots of enthusiasm for the books they publish. It was a great way to start.
And it's heartwarming to hear stories about educators who encourage their students the way your teacher did with you. Now, you work at Georgetown University, teaching creative writing and literature at the Center for Jewish Civilization and promoting student-centered teaching at the Center for New Designs in Learning and Scholarship. Let's talk about one of my favorite subjects when it comes to the arts, the power of observing.
I think it's at the center of everything. I mean, although I do think some people have a different take, you know, that maybe for other folks, it's action, you know, a story is the thing. And they launch from a place of what if and what might happen. And I think that's a great place to start. But for me, it's almost always with an observation. And I am a person who gets a little worked up about little things in my life, you know, where I sort of make too much out of small things, I think, and worry about them and so on. And that has sort of been a good thing for me as a writer, that I notice a lot of things, you know, small gestures that a person will make, or a slight twitch in their facial expression, or a tiny object in the grass that I'll notice as I'm walking around in my neighborhood, or all sorts of things. And things come out from those places for me. The one thing that stands out hangs with me for a long time. I once was crossing a bridge, and there was this, somebody had obviously brought groceries across the bridge and something had spilled. And there was just this kibble, this dog kibble there, and these pudding cups sitting in the kibble. And they're just all alone in this odd juxtaposition, you know, the thing you might eat, the thing you wouldn't eat, together. And for some reason, it really touched me. And it made me think about the person who has a dog and likes pudding. And the whole world started to emerge for me. And I, tiny thing, but I'll never forget it. So one thing I tell my students is that I hope being in a class with me will make them less efficient in their lives, that it will take them longer to walk down a street because they're busy noticing things. And they will go off on all sorts of side roads and tangents when they're in conversations, because little bits of language or little things they notice about the other person's emotions will take over. Efficiency is good in some ways, but it's not the best for writers.
And can you define student-centered teaching, please?
As you know, one of the places I work at Georgetown, and I have a very complicated Frankenstein's monster kind of a job, but a big part of it is in our teaching center. Which is called CANDLES, the Center for New Designs in Learning and Scholarship. And we're all about trying to make pedagogy stronger at Georgetown. I think there's already a big focus on teaching at Georgetown, but we're trying to reinforce that and strengthen that by starting with the student. So it isn't a question of what did you cover in class, but what happened for the student in class. It's not a question of just my interest as a teacher, but what gets the student really excited? What makes them feel included? What makes them feel involved and personally invested in what's going on in the classroom? And if you start with the student, then this crazy thing called learning happens. In a way, I'm much more interested in learning than I am in teaching, unless teaching is about learning. And I think if we're not thoughtful about it, it's not always about learning. It's about orating. So we have to start with the student.
And we're back to the word observing again. In my neck of the woods here in Southern California, we have the UCLA Lab School, which is for children ages 4 to 12. And for high school age children is the Geffen Academy at UCLA. So there's a lot of great work going on about educating educators and watching how children learn through play.
There are tons of people doing really interesting things out there. You know, I sort of fell into this work at the teaching center But I always was fascinated with not just teaching, but stepping back and thinking about teaching. And when you do step back, you find you have all sorts of allies throughout the institution who are also super fired up about students. But then even beyond the institution and throughout the country and world, all these people who are doing fascinating things. And teaching is one of the few places where stealing is encouraged. So when someone else has a great idea or lesson plan or syllabus, you know, grab it and go.
I read that you like to work on multiple pieces at a time. Is this the way you currently write, or do you tend to focus your energy on one project at a time?
I like that question a lot, because one of the things it points to is how we change over time as writers, and what's true of us at one moment isn't necessarily true at another. And you've hit the nail on the head in that I'm much more focused these days than I was. In the past, I have liked to have a short story I'm working on, a set of poems I'm working on, a novel I'm working on. And there are advantages to that. When you get frustrated and something's not working in one project, you can go somewhere else and see if maybe it works over there. And if you can get your confidence back on a different project. But in particular, now that I'm moving into this world of science fiction and novels in particular, my agent has big plans for me. And he, you know, he's interested in that next book and wants to see it. And I'm interested in him seeing it too. So I have been much more focused on that project. Though I'm later this summer, I have a plan to switch back to poetry for a little while when I have the first draft of this novel done.
And while we're on the subject of how situations change, in a 2017 JMWW blog interview, you said of your resistance to planning a novel, and I quote, "I write because I don't understand what I'm writing about, not yet, but the writing's going to help me understand. I love that experience, and I wouldn't want to risk killing it with a ham-fisted plan," end of quote. Has this thought changed for you over the past 4 years of writing, or do you stand true to your words?
It hasn't changed much. That one has stayed pretty constant. I will say that with a novel, there are moments where planning becomes really important. So let's say I get myself into a big mess, which is something that happens a lot when I'm writing. Then I'll have to step back and say, okay, what do I want to happen? And what's the order that things should take place? And what really is the larger destination and all of that? And so I sort of formulated a plan. It's almost always kind of wrong, but it gets me comfortable. And I go back in and it's a little right. So the book gets better, but then a new mess happens and I come back out and fix the plan and go back in. So this kind of iterative cycle with some planning happening, but never first. The plan is never first. It's only when I'm in big trouble does the plan start to happen. And in fact, my agent recently looked at pages of the novel I'm working on, and it turns out I'm in a big mess right now. So
I'm sorry I'm laughing, but it's just great to hear your honesty.
You have to laugh about it, don't you?
Absolutely. And my mantra is out of chaos comes creativity. So it's spot on.
But I don't like to start with a plan. I only go to it when I need it. And I do need it sometimes.
I'm going to turn now to one of your other books, The Artist's Torah, which is absolutely beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for writing it. In the book, you write, and I quote, "We fulfill our highest potential not when we are wealthy, necessarily, or when we're physically strong, or even when we're happy. In my opinion, no, we fulfill ourselves when we are in deep connection with the universe around us," end of quote. Do you remember the moment when you first experienced this sensation of connecting with the universe? And is this a sensation you can easily slip into, or rather one you are continually connected?
I think it's possible that I'm going to miss some point when I was younger and maybe didn't quite encode it in my memory. But the period that I think of the most is high school, which is when, for my 16th birthday, my sister bought me a copy of Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg, which was a book that changed my life in a pretty dramatic way, and it looks like permanently, and where writing became the thing. And she's all about that feeling of connectedness. She attaches that to her experience of Zen Buddhism. But the way that she encourages you to write with free writing and letting yourself go and just going for long stretches and seeing what happens, you just fall into everything that's around you. or you fall into yourself, or both, which are both great universes, the internal and the external universes. So I guess I would say that it started there. I forget the second part of your question, though.
Is this feeling of connectiveness something that you're able to slip in and out of, or rather something that's there continually?
I can't do it in a like a snap of a fingers that I'm suddenly feeling connected. But if I sit down and work on writing for a while, even journaling, to be honest, you know, a half an hour in, I'm probably starting to feel it. And if I can do it even more than that, you know, over the summer, I like to go on writing retreats. And so I'll be working all day, every day, continuously. And the whole world shifts when I'm immersed in writing. That kind of inefficiency I talked about before becomes extreme. And everything's interesting to me. And I stop to focus on everything. It's a delightful state to get into.
And whether you're painting or writing, there seem to be extremes. For example, we might write or paint for 12 or 18 or 19 hours without a break, and it just seems like an hour we've been working because we're in that zone of creativity. But on the other side of this experience is the part where we need to just stop. And if we're pushing and nothing is happening, that's when we really need to understand that it's time to take a break. Because I do believe it's important for our creativity to get a refill.
I totally agree. You know, in the artist's way, Julia Cameron talks about refilling the well or restocking the pond.
Pond, well.
Yeah. Putting stuff into a thing. That's why she wrote that book and I didn't. If we just charge directly at this thing that we want, I think we can deplete ourselves. We can, you know, bash our heads into the wall and not really get anywhere. So there is something to be said for tending to the soul, tending to the self, making room for all the aspects of human life. The very first writing retreat I went on, I was at this retreat center, and there was a board of directors meeting, I guess, for that center. So the director, the chair of the board was there, and she said, "Oh, hey, some of you are here for your first time. Let me just tell you, take breaks." And I thought, what do you know? And I just went ahead and wrote every possible second I could. And of course, she was totally right. And I crashed towards the end of my time there. And it didn't just mean that I couldn't write that day. It meant that I couldn't write for days. I was really stuck, and I went to the movies and I sat around a lot and was sad. And so now I always build in breaks. We can't just go and go and go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you and I were emailing back and forth, you wrote something that made me chuckle because it's true to me too. You said, "I've learned a lot more about people from fiction than psychology." When I read this, I began wondering if this is true for a lot of people. What are your thoughts?
I suppose that I think it's probably pretty complicated. I'm thinking about how many different ways of knowing there are and how they've all produced things that matter to us and that we care about. I know folks who stayed in the field of psychology and they do research in it and come out, you know, they return like a monk from the hills with wisdom, you know, glowing on them. They've done a study and they found a thing. And I don't know that writing fiction or reading fiction would do very much for them. I found that the kind of work I was doing in psychology, of looking at a bunch of people and sort of averaging across them to see what people generally do, it just didn't get me there. That instead, and this goes to your earlier question about observation, I think, if I look really closely at one person or one situation, that's where I learn. That's where I discover the universe. So that way of knowing feels inherently appealing to me, but I'm not sure it's universal. And I think about a friend of mine who's a mural painter, and he just thinks visually. And he really can come to understand the world in ways that I can't. A lot of his paintings or his murals have sort of squares in them, and they're sort of a grid pattern, but different colors, each of the squares. And he thinks a lot about the relationship between those squares, and particularly the pattern on a chessboard that a knight moves in, that L, the bottom and the top of that. He's like, the relationship between those colors is really important. And he's always trying to figure out what that ought to be. And it's not a thing that would ever occur to me. But I look at what he produces, and it's amazing. And I know he's found truth. So I guess I'm convinced that you have to find your way, whatever it is, for you as an individual.
Maybe that's why we are drawn to fairy tales and mythology, stories that lead us to an observation about a location or an event or a person, something relatable. And this brings me to my next question, which is the relationship between creativity and spirituality.
It's a big thing for me. In fact, it's a little hard to talk about because it's very hard for me to separate the two. When I'm in synagogue or having an otherwise Jewish religious experience, there's something rooted in the text that I'm facing. The experience I have is often kind of verbal and internal. It feels like poetry is happening when I'm there. And of course, sometimes you're actually literally encountering poetry in those services. So in that sense, a religious experience always ends up being a kind of a creative experience and a writing experience. And it goes the other way too, that feeling of connectedness I get from writing feels sacred. You know, as I say in the Artist Torah, that's the highest state. You know, that's the place I want to be. And there's a kind of a oneness, you know, certain visions of the universe suggest that there's no differentiation on some level, that we're all one thing, you know, that maybe we're waves in an ocean, but we're all water. And when I'm writing, sometimes there is a little bit that feeling of it. You know, Csikszentmihalyi talks about the flow state, an apt metaphor, I think, that moment when perhaps we are all water and we're all just flowing and not conscious of distinctions and differentiations. That's the only thing that makes it hard for me to talk about is it's hard for me to find a line between them.
Listening to you speak reminded me of a little book I've had for many years called Be Like Water, Practical Wisdom from the Martial Arts by Joseph Cardillo. In the beginning of the book, he says, practice going with the flow, be present, be confident, be spontaneous, and be free. Above all, be like water. So while we're talking about other books, what is one book, apart from one of your own, you'd like to see more people reading?
Well, this may be cheating because I think this book is doing fairly well. It's new and I think people are reading it, but if they're not, anybody who's not needs to. Kazuo Ishiguro's new book, Clara and the Sun, is, I think, a revelation. The fact is, I think the guy hasn't written a bad book, and which is a little crazy given that he's written so many really different things, that he's so comfortable in so many different styles. But one of the things he comes back to a lot and that you find in Clara and the Sun is this kind of reserved, quiet, understated observer of the world. And in this case, it's artificial intelligence, sort of a android figure who is nonetheless gorgeously sensitive. It is such a pleasure to be with her quiet take on the world and to see the ways in which, in some ways, she is quite unreliable and quite naive and misunderstands a lot. And in some other ways, she understands much more than most of us do. So that book is so full of wisdom that I think everybody would get a lot from it.
It seems everyone who has read that book absolutely loves it. A friend of mine said to me that if you only read the synopsis, you might think it's not a book I want to read. But then she said, everybody needs to read this book. So you're not alone in your thoughts. It sounds wonderful.
You know, it's science fiction, which some people get excited about. But it's also not for the folks who think of themselves as just reading literary fiction. It's really about how do you make kind of moral decisions in your life? How do you find purpose? How do you find love? You know, what is a family? All these questions that we all care about.
Thank you for taking time out and being on the show, David. I've thoroughly enjoyed chatting with you. And I wish you all the best with How to Mars, your new book, available at your favorite indie bookshop. And I look forward to chatting with you again in the near future.
Well, thanks so much for making this space. This has been great.
Producing a podcast takes a lot of work, from researching guests, editing interviews, producing the show, and marketing. If you're enjoying the Bookshop Podcast, and I sure hope you are, here are a few ways you can support the ongoing episodes. You can subscribe to the show, leave a review, and share the link with family and friends and on social media. You can also support me by going to thebookshoppodcast.buzzsprout.com, click on the small orange heart at the top right-hand corner of the page, and donate using PayPal. Thanks in advance. Now, on with the second half of the show. In 1973, Alan Stipek purchased Second Story Books in Northwest Washington, D.C. Over the years, the store expanded into multiple locations to become one of the largest used and rare bookstores in the world. With the growth of the internet, Second Story Books consolidated its brick-and-mortar presence into its two current locations, the DuPont Circle store in D.C. and the Rockville Warehouse store in Rockville, Maryland. Alan is a member of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, the International League of Antiquarian Booksellers, and is a senior member of the American Society of Appraisers. Alan co-hosted the Book Guys radio show with Mike Cuthbert on C-SPAN and has appeared as an appraiser on Antiques Roadshow and Chesapeake Collectibles on Maryland Public Television. Hi, Alan, and welcome to the show.
Man, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. How about we start at the beginning of your bookish story, from flea markets and estate sales to retail bookshop owner and appraiser?
Well, my bookish starting was when I was about 7 years old, and I collected books at a very early age. And I always was responsible for the group books when I would go to day camp or sleepaway camp or in high school book reading programs. So when I moved to Washington to go to college, I took my book collection with me. After graduating my undergraduate, I was intending to go into the government in one or two capacities, but was on a kind of a semi-break to make a decision. So I decided to sell books at a flea market because I was going traveling and buying books for myself and buying antiques for a friend. And we set up a flea market stall, and we also put some books in my friend's antique store. And the book sold almost overnight. And so all of a sudden, I had this opportunity to go on a weekly basis, travel up and down the East Coast into Canada, buy books, put them out for sale. And I was making a fairly substantial income doing nothing. I never intended it to be my profession. I made a vow I would never open a bookstore. And I thought it was going to be short term, and maybe in 6 months, a year, I'd go into what was going to be my true profession. But my true profession turned out to be a bookseller, because within a year, not only did I totally overplay my vow not to open a bookstore, I bought a bookstore, which is my friend's Second Story Books. And the main reason I opened the bookstore is Paul Collins, who's also an ABAA member, was the owner of the store. We went together and we wound up buying Golda Meyerson's library. Now, you know who Golda Meyerson became? Golda Meir. And this was all the books she had when she was in law school at GW in Washington. So that was the first major collection I bought. So I bought the bookstore from Paul, who wanted to move to Virginia. And within 5 or 6 years, I had built up a clientele base in the DC area, where we had in 1980, six stores operating between Virginia up to Baltimore. This was a short-term perspective. I never intended to keep that large an organization. It's just impossible to run. But over the years, we kind of expanded and contracted. We were elastic. We would have 3 stores, 4 stores, 5 stores, whatever. But the core stores were the one we have currently now in Rockville, and the bookstore, which we've had since 1977 at DuPont Circle.
And with the growth of your business and multiple stores, did each store have its own specialty, or was the style and curation fairly consistent?
There was a period where we did expand in Baltimore. We had an art gallery, movie theater, bar, restaurant. It was Alan's Folly. It was too overwhelming, and it was juggling too many balls at the same time. It worked very well in some ways, but unless you're prepared to like own a restaurant and you're going to be there 24/7, you can't do these multi-dimensional stores, because it requires, to me, an enormous amount of collaborative relations with other individuals. So to specifically have individual stores within different inventories, you would have to have different clientele bases, and you'd have to have different focuses with your employees. We feel that now we have this kind of continuity where the stores carry the same inventories, maybe in different degrees of value based on presentation, but there's a uniformity in the scoping content.
And is DC a hub for antiquarian and rare book buyers?
Well, DC has a very famous line. DC is not a money town. DC is a power town. So yeah, you do not get as much voracious buying as you might in New York or LA, where there's a lot of power money or real money. In DC, there's a lot of interest in books. It's a highly educated area. Most families that are in government usually are two income earning family members with at least a college degree, if not postgraduate degree. So there is an enormous amount of book readers which buy books voraciously. It doesn't translate into rare book buyers, but it does give you a clientele base of continuity and reliability. And that's been our key for the last 47 years, is the ongoing purchasing of libraries from transient population. I mean, we've handled the same book maybe four or five times in the last 40 years. People bought it from us, then they move out of the area, they sell us back in bulk, it's sold to somebody else. You know, DC probably has 25% of the population is non-transient. And when I came to Washington, there was a Washingtonian magazine t-shirt that said, "I'm not a tourist, I live here." And I finally was allowed to wear one after being here for 8 years after school. But it's the reality of our market being combination of transient individuals, which give us opportunities to buy and sell, the intellectual educational level, and the sheer curiosity of our clientele base, which is eclectic. So that's given us probably a very reinforcing security of the operation on an ongoing basis.
Is there a particular area in the world that you see as being inundated with antiquarian and rare book buyers?
I think it's everywhere. I'm sure in academic towns, especially in Europe and England, they still have those clusters of pure academics. I'm sure people up in Cambridge and Boston will say the same. Any large population density, New York City, you know, the obvious places where you have academic, structural anchored libraries, you're going to have the academics and the librarians that go along with it. And in D.C., we have it basically in our institutions. We have Library of Congress, Smithsonian, the Dibden Library of the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian has 23 libraries. The Folger, then you can invent all the college libraries, which are fairly substantial. I mean, Georgetown has a wonderful library. So, you know, we probably have it from a different perspective, but ours are not clusters of collectors. It's more repositories of information.
You spoke earlier about having the restaurant and a movie theater and more bookshops, but what is your favorite part of your job?
My favorite part is my appraising and my consultation. I have a very sophisticated practice. I represent Henry Kissinger, Madeleine Albright, 9 Nobel Prize winners, of which 4 are still alive. And the opportunities to be the fly on the wall, to be the consultant, to work on archives at this level on an ongoing basis, plus all the material we see when we do appraising for institutions, private collectors, on an ongoing basis. It's not only refreshing, but it's mentally and physically stimulating. I'm 71 years old. And people say, "When are you going to retire?" And I said, "I can't retire, because if I retired, I'd be doing exactly what I do now." Just to put into perspective, what I'm doing this month alone in appraising is we're doing a English Renaissance collection, which has original manuscripts from British royalty to Shakespeare, which has a second Shakespeare folio, a first edition of the poems. It's an evolving foundation from an individual's related in to the Folger, but not directly. I'm also appraising for the Smithsonian 800,000 pieces of type. I'm appraising a World War I diaries. I mean, this is what we're doing simultaneous right now. A presidential library of letters from a privately held collector. And it's just every single week we get work that is just phenomenal. We have an intelligence library that I'm reviewing again, probably the largest intelligence library in public hands, in private hands going into a public held institution. And so from that perspective, to be able to have the interaction with people, to sit down with a person who's won the Nobel Prize and have him explain to you how, not how he won it, but what he did or she did to win it. And you just sit there and you listen. You can't script stuff like that.
Yeah.
We talked before, the more you do interviews, since, we have this commonality, we come from the same tribe, the interviewer is the person getting the opportunity. It's not the interviewee. We absorb so much by being in the presence of another individual or having the access to the presence. You know what the rewards of your interviews are.
Building relationships and listening to great stories.
Yeah. And last night I had a preliminary interview with a person who I'm on an NDA. We had about 9 1 degrees of separation of people that we neither knew or worked with. And he told me stories about people that this is just the preliminary conversation before I actually do his archives, where you then become the most intimate person in this person's life next to their lover, because they spill everything out, or you read everything, and you have an obligation now for life, because you are responsible. You're telling people what they're worth. They're teaching you on the spot history, academic, literary, everything. It's unbelievable how the scope and content that you absorb.
Everything boils down to the art of story. And in addition to appraising, do you also do curating for clients?
All the time. Yeah, it's we'll get collections. They'll come in. Right now, we're trying to place 5 separate collections in 5 different categories. I mean, the pandemic was a complete disaster, as you know, for everybody. Institutions shut down. In February of 2020, I had 3 relationships with institutions that were reviewing major collections. One in photography, one in Spanish colonial manuscripts, one in advertising, all ready to take the next step of review. And everything just, it just came to a stop. And now the post-pandemic issues are so unreliable because institutions don't have the funding they expected. Half their staffs are not coming back or are in a kind of a confused state of where to work. I mean, in the last year, we had to transfer from, bricks and mortar appraising, hands-on appraising, to Zoom appraising. Now, imagine trying to do archival appraising, reading letters. I mean, one of my clients is responsible for 2 major American authors, a husband and wife team, that I had to review all their letters. And they're very significant, but trying to do this, imagine holding up letters, you and I, for hours, trying to read the text of the letters and trying to figure out in what's the substantive nature of A versus the general nature of another. How are we going to assign value based on historic content versus academic and literary perspective? What is important because it has historical information hereto never seen? And it maybe not create a revisionist appraisal understanding, but would add to historical content. And you're asking somebody that you normally would be doing it by yourself to read it to you. So everything now is kind of, everybody's coming out in their individual, like I have one store, I'm in my office right now, and you can't see behind you, but I have $500,000 of items which are being donated to 3 institutions in this area that I've done over the last year that can't be delivered because they're still shut down. And it's at least it's a safe haven here. And it's great, it's great to know that they're going to the institutions. But the unregularity of the pre-COVID period, where you knew how everything basically worked step by step, now everything is irregular to a point that some institutions depend on us to be the intermediaries to hold the collections And, you know, we've been able to actually secure material for schools because they were closed. And so we came in between. So as a consultant, I actually went out proactively when people approached me and said, listen, I know an institution, I want this, but they're shut down. Let me make a phone call. And I'll ask them if they want to hold it until they reopen. And so from that perspective, that's one of the ways we consult. And that's how we've helped institutions build up during the COVID shutdown material.
And at the beginning of COVID, remember, we didn't know what we could touch. It must have been a really insane time for you.
Oh, it was, you know, it's funny. I learned how to read a book with gloves on. Now, that sounds like it, not extraordinary when you're in a library world because they always give you gloves, right? But to actually handle paperbacks with gloves, and, you know, and it was easy to adapt to. What was confusing for us was trying to explain the flotsam and jetsam from the substantive material. And that's from a consulting perspective is also important because we'll get institutions to ask us, do you think it's worth taking this material for permanent access? And with the scope and content of space in institutions now being restricted, with everything going from analog to born digital, with the fact that there's budget cuts going on almost on an hourly basis, you know, institutions get all these offers. And there's also the age factor. Now, remember how many people have collected books for 50 to 60 years who are now depending on their collections to be refocused into an institution, and institutions no longer have the space for them because things have changed. So how do you pick the collections that you could at least pitch to an institution or suggest to an institution would be worth retaining? And then the institutions have to pare down. How do you choose what would be appropriate to stay in the analog version, the tactile version, versus putting it into born digital? You know, and so that's also part of it. And that doesn't take into consideration the rare material. That's just, you know, from the use of information.
Another arm of Second Story Books is restoration and repair. Is this something you've been able to continue with the pandemic?
Actually, we've backed that out. COVID has really done it's a number on us because the person who was doing our work, because of COVID, we wound up having to kind of shut it down because of the fear of holding something tactile. It really, you know, honestly, the customer relationship usage of our repair and, you know, and restoration department had to stop out of responsibility to the clientele or vice versa to our employees who were handling that because of the danger of contamination. So we're actually on a hold pattern until maybe September when we're reconsidering if we're going to go back, because we have to ask every individual. You know, when you come into our warehouse, you have to handle our books. You have to wear gloves. You know, it's I don't want to call it a casualty, but it's certainly a short-term issue.
You spoke earlier about the need for institutions such as universities having to decline acceptance of collections, either due to finances or space. Has the same applied to private collectors?
I think age is the defining factor. I think, honestly, if you were going to do a census of people who collect books or have a interest in the scope and content of specific areas, you're going to find that generationally it decreases radically. Every time I've lectured, I open my lectures with, will anybody who's under 40 raise their hands? And with the exception of a couple of guys who think it's really funny, we're like 70 years old and they raise their hands, you get maybe 3% of your audience. And my second question is, did you come here voluntarily or did your grandparents or your parents take you? Or are you bringing your grandparents? And then the hands go down to 1%. And that is pretty much the accurate field identification of our marketplace. The majority of people that collect have usually been in the age bracket of 45, 50 years or older. And they're their life have been integrated with analog, not born digital. Born digital comes into the true vernacular in 1994. That's when you start having, as an archivist, to have to take the born digital material and calculate that in relation to the previous analog material, especially if you're doing archival papers. So you have to assume that the book collecting habits of individuals that were pre-born digital are more consistent. Post-born digital, more people turn to reading online, or with the exception of people that respected book collecting or artifactual collecting, the majority of the younger generations are not specifically interested in that concept of collecting. It doesn't mean there are collectors, but it means that the majority of the people are older. The one thing we get on a daily basis is people coming in and saying, my kids and my grandkids don't want my library. And we, and you know, and half the time, people will call us up in advance and say, listen, I know that I can't will it, and I want to, you know, dissemble it now. I want to deconstruct it while I'm alive. Can you give me the names of institutions, or do you want to buy them? So institutions are overwhelmed with collections that are becoming available. The funding of collections is also disproportionately been restricted because more money goes into the born digital aspect of the transition of library information going from analog to born digital. Now, how many times have you been in a library where the term library has now been changed to social media center? How many college libraries have you gone into where there isn't a book on the first floor, where books are relegated to the second, third, or to a special section in the back, and everything when you walk in the first floor is all computer generated or is social media generated, and justifiably, because how many students actually use books for their primary academic research? They might supplement it. So when you're looking at it from the perspective of an antiquarian bookseller or a generalist like us, we have to put in perspective the actual use need. And so we have to go to institutions which still are dedicating space. They may have specific collections. A lot of institutions know now they can't be generalists. They have to put together special collections. One of the collections that I've helped put together over the years has been the Animal Rights Collection in North Carolina State University. And oddly enough, I just got one of the major collections that hasn't been put into the public, and NC State turned it down because it was duplicative of everything they already had. So collections build up, and then you'll get a major collection, and the institution has said, we have to cherry pick. We can only take what we don't have. And that destroys the continuity. So you have to go to another institution and say, listen, I have a core collection that it would be a sin to split it up, but it would be great for usage if I can find an institution. Maybe you can build up a collection. What I've worked on is in the intelligence community, we've created three major collections and three separate institutions because of the overlap. And so schools are built up and they can interact with each other. They can have consortiums and they can share information. But ultimately, no school in the 21st century is going to be looking to build up analog collections unless they have a dedicated purpose. They're going to have to stay conscious of how information is now transported.
I hear what you're saying, Alan, but it does make me a little sad.
You have to get past that point. You got a man up here and basically say, it's you know, we're in a new world. We don't want it to be a brave new world. We want all this information not to be taken away. We don't want people to create revisionist history and crop out photos and crop out words. We just want it to be used in an appropriate manner. If the material can be then transferred into a different aspect, as long as there's repositories that keep the original text. And I work on that with a lot of institutions where there's a dedication that the books will remain and the archival papers will remain. So there's no chance of perverting the information. As long as those stay constant, then it's the evolution. And you got to just understand how to use all this information.
When I look at Instagram and how many people are hashtagging books and bookish and bookstagram, I know there are millions of people out there who adore physical books. I mean, the photos they take are extraordinary.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. We advertise on Instagram and on Facebook, and probably we're the 25th, 26th of February, of May. We've had about 125,000 hits on one of our Facebook ads this month. That's a lot of shared material. No, there's no question that you can go born digital and still deal with collecting. And it's probably the vehicle we use more often than anything else. It's just the question of accepting the formatting of how to make this information transfer and be used. And if you can basically put together groups of in-kind people, that's the positive nature of using the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I guess the sad part is if there's a library that's been in a family for many, many years and institutions only want to take a part of that library, a part of the collection, and it has to be split up, that's where it gets really sad. And we're lucky that there are places like the Library of Congress where, whenever possible, are prepared to keep a collection together, providing it is something that they have a need for.
In my case, I moved down to college. I took my book collection and my father's. And my father called me up like 2 days after I had moved down. And he said, "Where are my goddamn books?" Right? And I was like, "Oh, I still got them boxed, Dad." And he goes, "Bring them home." And I said, "Yeah, maybe in a month or two." Right? No. So, you know, it's interesting because we come from generationally dedicated book collecting and also personal interest. From that philosophy, you know, both my daughters are teachers. They're late 20s, and they've been brought up reading. And so they've transferred our love of books to the kids they teach with, and they try to balance books and internet simultaneously. So there is ways, obviously, to make these transfers generationally. But ultimately, I think you're right. The LOC and major institutions' responsibilities are to maintain the focus on the history of and the transition to the different forms of information gathering. And as long as you have these repositories and people who are capable of being reliable, I mean, I'll tell you, we get kids that come out of MLS programs, they don't know anything about books. They're all computer oriented. I'm not saying it categorically, but I've had 5 or 6 job interviews here where we have something called the quiz. And the quiz is, Who wrote The Jungle? What's a muckraker? Okay. Name 3 people that won the Nobel Prize for Literature in the 1950s. You know, just all over the map. You get 1 out of 10 right, you got a chance for a job. 90% of the time, right? 90% of the time, the only people these kids know is Rawlings, and they'll quote Harry Potter to us, right? But it's not being sarcastic or being, you know, it's the fact that kids are brought up on a completely different menu, a completely different recipe of foods that are mind stimulating. And so to be able to give them the opportunities to go further back and have them come in here, I understand why MLSs have to have computers as primary before they become specialists. So, you know, we have responsibilities. We understand who we are. I used to joke around, or I had a whole, you know, it's like a lonely men's club. I would have a bunch of men my age when in the 60s, all collected books, military and history and stuff. They come to the warehouse and they cluster around. And I said, "Here's the deal, guys. As long as you stay alive, I'll keep the bookstore open. Because you guys are my clientele base, right? You're my bread and butter. You know, you're never going to go onto a computer. It's almost like it's a mortal sin, right? So you'll always be buying books, you know? And I feed my 90-year-old uncle books every 2 weeks. And he sends them down to his nephews who are my age, who are 70, right? And, you know, there's ways. The books will stay in the system one way or the other.
Yes, I believe you're right about that. Now, is there a particular volume you've held in your hands and thought, "Ah, oh, now this is something special"?
There's been a lot of them, but the best moment was I used to do my radio show simulcast with Brian Lamb on C-SPAN. And one of the C-SPAN simulcasts we used to do was we did a radio show, an appraisal day, from the Library of Congress, Jefferson, from the great reading room in the lobby. Now, you've been there, and you've seen that lobby. Unbelievable, right? Can you imagine broadcasting live and have people coming in, bringing you material, and you're live on television or live to tape and on radio in the same show? One person brought in Frederick Douglass's son's family Bible, who was the Frederick Douglass's son, who was in the, remember the movie Glory?
Sure.
That he was in that, in the 154 regiment. It had all of Frederick Douglass's family's photographs, including the Frederick Douglass's daughter who passed away at 12, one of the only known two photographs. That was one. The other item, which is what really juiced me for 2 years, was a fourth edition of Thomas More's, Sir Thomas More, St. Thomas More's volume of Utopia. The fourth edition is very important because right before he printed it, he had a meeting with Erasmus, who came to visit him. And so if you look at the title page of the fourth edition, it's the first time there's an actual individual on the hill going up to the castle. And it is supposed to be Erasmus. This copy had annotations throughout in an Elizabethan hand. And it came from an area outside of Jamestown in Virginia, which made sense. So it was an early Cromwellian who left during the war, was that the Cavaliers? Those were all the people who came to Jamestown in that area. It would make sense. And so I, along with a member of the Library of Congress, a member of the Folger, and two other individuals, spent a year and a half trying to figure out if that was Sir Thomas More's hand-annotated copy of the fourth. And if it was, and not only was it rare from that perspective, it's also a religious relic because he's a saint. And so I did all the due diligence imaginable. And we went years back. We went to the Bodleian. We were at the Folger. And we were like, please be right, you know, just be right. And we couldn't categorically come to a determination until the census was it wasn't, because we must have studied, and I'm not exaggerating, 500 known pieces of Sir Thomas More's signatures over a period of time, specifically at the point where the fourth was printed. And it turned out that I sold it to an individual who was a More scholar, with the caveat that he said that I promised, if it turns out to be right, I'll get back to you and we'll renegotiate what I paid for it, right? But it was, to me, it was the quest. And it was, I mean, it may not have been in the long run the most expensive book we ever handled. It was, obviously wasn't, because we've handled three Audubon portfolios. I've handled two Dunlop copies of the Declaration of Independence. So I've been up in the eight-figure category, and they're extraordinary. But from the thrill, from the actual kind of, from point A to point B, and everything that went into the academic study of it, the background of it, the interaction with scholars, that was what we're here for. That was playtime.
I bet it was. And I also saw you on Antiques Roadshow, and you were appraising a letter, and I believe it has something to do with the Titanic.
Oh, yeah. That's the greatest hits of the Antiques Roadshow. Yeah, that was the first or second year of the Roadshow. And it was the letter that was written by the women who survived on the Carpathia, which was one of the two ships that picked up the survivors. And it was a letter written in hand by the women who survived to the captain of the ship for saving them. And that came in off, I think I did that in Chicago, but I know that the Roadshow made that in there. They have these greatest hits of the Roadshow. And so for years, this is a funny side story. My kids weren't allowed to watch television without permission, right? So they were smart enough to go and see the TV schedule, and they would hook in to when the Antiques Roadshow would be on air, and they would replay that segment on local TV with some frequency. So they would find it and run me and say, "Dad, you're on television. Dad, you're on television," for an excuse to change the channel to some cartoon channel. This became a family joke. Oh, Dad's on TV again. And I had the kind of je ne sais quoi that, kids, I've been there. We've done that. Okay. That was, you know, probably from a historical perspective, you know, that letter ultimately wound up, I believe, sold at auction, if I'm not mistaken. And I can't remember. I didn't follow the trajectory of it, but somebody told me that. Yeah, that was an interesting. I did it. I've done over the last 7 years. Unfortunately, we stopped broadcasting because of COVID. I've done a local show called the Chesapeake Collectibles, which was similar to the Roadshow, but it's on Maryland Public Television dedicated. And over the years, we found stuff that were just unbelievable, $100,000 items. You know, it's amazing what comes out. You know, when you do appraisal days, it's like things that nobody would ever even tell you they have surface. And it's extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary what comes out. You say, you've had that in your what? In your closet? You know, I mean, you got to be kidding, you know? You know, that's worth $150,000. Not only that, it's historically really important. I mean, I had one item come in. It was a letter that was by George Washington's personal spy writing a letter for the Treaty of Paris to Lord Salisbury, who is the representative for the English, where George Washington tells Thomas Dix, who is his spy, also a representative, and he's a double agent with the British, but he's really an American spy, giving the British false information on the American delegation that John Adams is an Anglophile, Thomas Jefferson is a Francophile, you know, this one, John Jay, is a this or that, all misinformation to screw up the negotiations. And this is sitting in somebody's trunk along with $200,000 of other Revolutionary War material that they never thought about taking out of the house, but they saw appraisal day. You know, it's amazing.
It's interesting what we keep and what we carry and have hidden in boxes under beds.
Yeah, and what people don't really even think about until there's an opportunity to bring it and get some FaceTime and share it in a certain kind of environment. I don't know how much of it is personal desire to be on television, or it's they're waiting for the time to actually share it.
My take on it is this. Some people feel that if they were to get a monetary appraisal of a certain object, does that take away from the emotional connection that person has with that object to a loved one? Perhaps it's something like that.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting because the term we use in the trade is the aha moment. So you set up the introduction, then you set up the interview in a way to have the individual explain the history, scope, and content. You add your individual knowledge of it. You try to build together a narrative where you share with the person who owns it the personality of the item, their personality. And then there's this pregnant pause where you ask them if they've ever had it appraised, and they say no, and you stop. And that's the aha moment where all time stands still, right? Everybody's, you know, and then you hit them with the number, and you always, you know, you want to see if their eyes brighten. And the best is when the person is discouraged and they pretend they're happy. They just come out and it's almost impossible to disguise. And, you know, I've had people scream so loud that I thought I'd lose my hearing, you know, and they wanted to do it. I mean, it's an extraordinary life experience to be able to tell people, oh, by the way, you have a $250,000 item, and you're not inflating it because you're trying to do a kind of a television moment. But in real time, you've discovered something really cool.
One final question. Do you miss your show, The Book Guys?
Oh, gosh. I mean, how much am I babbling before the show and now, right? When we discontinued the show, I was in, I could have gone into rehab. I was in withdrawal every Tuesday night for 6 months because I was Pavlovian. I spent 3 to 5 hours a week reading a book, which I loved, right? Because I got the opportunity to interview a person, touched a lot of really interesting material. And then I was like, you know, it wasn't there. And it wasn't the show that being on, I mean, honestly, it wasn't being performer. It was the interaction, the extraordinary opportunity to any day, any show, talk to, like, you know, as you say, your guest. I mean, I would have a Nobel Prize winner, or we'd have a historian, we would have a, you know, just a, you know, a civilian, you know, and who had a great story or a collection. And you just never, it never got dull. And, you know, and that is what I miss, the exceptional opportunities for something spontaneous to happen.
Well, it was great chatting with you today, Alan. I wish you all the best, and hopefully we'll get to chat again.
Give me a call. We could probably go five different directions at once. Thank you very much. It's been a golden opportunity.
Make sure to follow me on Instagram and Facebook at The Bookshop Podcast. To learn more about upcoming speaking engagements, my books, and my Art of Observing workshops, go to my website at mandyjacksonbeverly.com. You can sign up for my newsletter or contact me directly at mandy@cricketpublishing.org. And follow me on social media at Mandy Jackson Beverly. Read global, buy local, support your local indie bookshop.